Welcome, everybody, to episode number 42 of Nerds United. Going back to Cape Girardeau, Missouri, in the 10th annual Cape Comic-Con for another panel. In fact, this being the last of the panels and being joined by, well, joined by, I'm not even in the panel. You'll hear me towards the end. But being on the panel is Colin Bunn, who has written for Marvel and DC, and has some creator-owned work out there as well. So they'll be talking about The Sixth Gun. They'll be talking about his work on Magneto and Sinestro. And they'll be talking about the newest project, which I think you're going to like, Hellbreak. And we'll talk about more of that here in just a second. The panel is moderated, if you will, by Steve Higgins, who I'll have on the show here in the near future. Got a chance to visit with him at the Cape Comic-Con. He's another independent creator and a pretty cool guy and a professor or instructor at a college here in Illinois. So these two know each other, have had this conversation in the past, and there are a few questions from the audience, including yours. Truly. But it is the Hellbreak panel, although they only really touched on Hellbreak there at the very end, as they were. It was supposed to start at 10 o'clock. Part of it is my fault. We'll get to that in Saturday's episode, but part of it was my fault, the reason for the delay. I'm not going to tell the Cape Comic-Con organizer Ken Murphy that. I don't want him to banish me from future cons, but we're running a little behind, and the crowd was already starting to assemble for the Misty Brew experience, which I actually did not stick around for that. I had to run errands again. We'll get to that one on Saturday. So a crowd was starting to build up there in the hallway. We'll not call it Hall H. We'll call it Hall J. Sure, why not, at the Osage Center in Cape Girardeau. So Ken kind of popped his head in and says, let's wrap it up. And so, again, didn't get to near as much Hellbreak talk as I'm sure they would have liked, but they did give out 500 free copies of Hellbreak at the Cape Comic-Con, Hellbreak number one. And it was something that I had actually seen, was a little bit aware of it, saw it on the wall at my brick-and-mortar store over in Shiloh, Illinois, by the name of Twilight Comics. And so with this Saturday being Free Comic Book Day 2015, I encourage you, when you're going out there and scooping up the freebies, to ask your clerk, your manager, whatever it is, ask them about Hellbreak and see if they can acquire it if they don't have it. I read Hellbreak number one. I really enjoyed it, and they have definitely already set the stage for an intriguing storyline that I can't wait to continue reading. I posted to my comic book shops, Twilight Comics again. I posted to their Facebook page just this week and said, would you mind, putting this in my list, my poll folder? And they said, done. So, and that's with them, amidst a location move that they are making. So, very excited to continue reading the work of Colin Bunn. Picked up also volume one of The Sixth Gun, which you'll hear in the episode. They actually drew up and wrote and shot a pilot episode for that. So we'll hear more about that. But also, Colin has done a lot of writing in the Deadpool world, wrote some of the tie-ins for Fear Itself back, a few years back. And Fear Itself was as simply put as possible. That's what I'm trying to say. Fear Itself, by my very vague understanding, because I've only read the story, the main story once, and I haven't caught all the tie-ins, but there is sort of an abundance of Mjolnirs, these enchanted weapons that fall to earth, and those who are worthy in a way are able to wield them, and so a lot of people become these Asgardian almost titans. In the Greek realm, in the Greek mythos, it's titans and then the gods and goddesses, things like that. And so I would almost put these characters in a titan-esque category You know, like they are older than the basic Asgardians we come to know. But if you haven't read for yourself, I'm not doing it justice. But I encourage you to, you know, look a little bit more into that. And so we will see exactly what you think of Fear Itself. I'm excited for Hellbreak, and I think you're going to enjoy this panel. And again, we'll talk about technical difficulties and all that fun stuff on the weekend show. Something to give you a little something to listen to as you head out to Free Comic Book Day on Saturday. So I'll have another episode in which we'll be hearing from legendary Marvel artist Greg Land. And I was able to visit with him for a few minutes Saturday of the 10th annual Cape Comic Con. So you can again prep yourself for that one. And so very excited for this episode, for my sort of weekend recap, if you will. I'll tell you all about my experience at the Cape Comic Con. And that will be, again, look for that one on Saturday with the Greg Land interview. And also, he says with phlegm in his throat, going to see Marvel's Avengers Age of Ultron this Friday night with some friends. And much like we did kind of on the spot, without any warning or preparation, for Guardians of the Galaxy, we got some post-show thoughts and analysis. I plan on certainly sharing my thoughts with you for Saturday morning's episode, but hopefully I can get some of my friends on the microphone once again. And so we'll look forward to that. It's going to be a busy rest of the week. It all starts with episode number 42 of Nerds United, and it is brought to you by Amazon.com. Yes, I'm sure you've heard of Amazon.com. They've been around for a while, and they have all sorts of goods and what is it? Good. I don't want to say services. They don't really. I mean, they provide the service of I don't have to drive to the city to get what I want. but a lot of things that I get, come from Amazon. I mean, it's where I do my online shopping. I go to Amazon first, and they've never let me down. And I've bought a plethora, an abundance, a variety of items from Amazon.com, and I'm sure you have too over the years, especially if you maybe live out in a real little bit more of a rural location like I do, where you know the nearest mall to me. Let me rephrase: the nearest mall worth going to is a good hour drive, and I'm an hour and a half from St. Louis, you know, in the quote-unquote city. So, so check out Amazon.com, and if you don't mind, head over to jitterymonkey.com/NerdsUnitedPodcast and use that Amazon link, that banner, that badge, whatever you want to call it, and help out the show a little bit and support the sponsors. Again, you can get anything you want from Amazon. I've yet to experience the inability to purchase something that I'm after when I purchase from Amazon.com. Yeah, I mean, that seems to make sense. I mean, and I'm not, you know, trying to buy babies or, you know, dogs or roosters or anything like that, farm animals. But I've never had a bad problem with, never a bad situation with Amazon. So if you want to support the show, do so at Amazon and use the link from jitterymonkey.com/NerdsUnitedPodcast. I appreciate it. You'll appreciate it. I'll throw a link onto the Sixth Gun, and you can purchase that straight from this post on jitterymonkey.com. And I appreciate it. And find us on iTunes and Stitcher, and be on the lookout for all the other great shows on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. Without any further ado, we will hear from Colin Bunn right after this.
Comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! It's Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get started, I guess. I'm Steve Higgins. I teach at Lewis and Clark Community College in Godfrey, Illinois, which is St. Louis area, and teach a class on comic books as literature, which Cullen has come a few times and spoken to, and basically what you're going to get is pretty much what we do when I have him come to talk to my class, kind of an overview of his career. Specifically, we'll be talking about his most recent stuff, like Hellbreak and Harrow County coming out in a week. Is that when's Harrow County out?
Harrow County comes out on May 13th.
Okay, so
we can talk about it for sure.
Yeah,
and yes, if anything you know about me and my writing is that it's literature.
Very literate, definitely. All right, so this is Cullen Bunn, Marvel DC Oni Press auteur.
Yes.
And let's start, I guess, by talking a little bit about your background. Whenever I do this, when you're with my class, you know, it's always good. My students always like to hear kind of your educational background.
I think we were in the wrong.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. It happens. All right. Tell me a little bit about your educational background.
Literature, we're out. I've been writing. Next year will be my 10-year anniversary of writing comics professionally. I have always wanted to tell stories. I've wanted to write or tell stories in some fashion since I was very, very young. It took me a long time to break into comics because I am no longer very, very young. And I wasn't when I broke. I was not very, very young when I broke into comics either. And that just, it was a number of things. I didn't know how to break into comics. I didn't know how to introduce myself to editors. I didn't know how to tilt that windmill, so to speak, to introduce myself to publishers. So I focused for a long time on prose because I knew how to write. I knew how to submit short stories to editors or to submit novel proposals. I knew what the process was for that, but I didn't really understand how to get into the comics industry for a long while. It was after several years I finally figured out the formula that it takes to get into comics for me, which is different for everybody who gets in. But since that time, I've been writing professionally almost 10 years. I've been writing full time as the first half of that I was also maintaining a day job. I was working all day and writing at night, and I've been writing full time now for 4 years or so, maybe over 4 years. I think I can't remember.
And you said you always wanted to write from a very young age. What kind of comics interested you when you were young, and what kind of stories really grabbed a hold of you?
You know, and it wasn't necessarily comics that was the thing that I wanted to write, although I loved comics from a very early age, and I was lucky enough to grow up at a time where I could go to a garage sale and buy a stack of 30 comics for less than a dollar, and I could go to a flea market, and I remember there was a guy that used to, my parents loved garage sales and flea markets, and I loved it because there were always comic books and toys I liked. But I remember there was a guy that used to sell grocery sacks full of random comics. It was like 50 comics for $5 out of the back of a pickup truck. And I'd save up my allowance, and I'd buy two grocery sacks full of comics every week, and it was just random stuff. And so I loved all those stories. It wasn't that I was stuck on any one character or one storyline. It was I was reading whatever I could get my hands on in comics and just kind of devouring that. And I wanted to draw for a while, but I was a terrible artist. Or I was a good artist, I just never, I didn't maintain practice. I didn't practice, so I didn't keep that, I didn't hone those skills over time.
Yeah, I kind of remember what that was like, too, when growing up, like, give me a comic and I will read it.
Yeah.
I don't care what it is. Chuck Norris, okay, I'll read it. Random House of Mystery from DC, okay, I'll read it.
Right.
You don't have loyalties. You're just happy to read comics.
Yeah, no, and this was a time where I wasn't, when you bought your comics, and some of you may remember this, you might buy an issue I'm not looking at you, sir, because that's all I can tell you. You will probably remember this. You'd buy an issue of a comic, but it was very likely that you wouldn't find the next issue. Yeah. You wouldn't necessarily have a store to go to that had the next issue of the book on the shelf. So it could be months before you'd read another issue in that storyline. But I don't know. There was a magic to that, I guess. I really liked that time.
I feel like a large part of my adulthood at comic conventions like this has been going back and finding issues 1 and 3.
Right.
Because when I was a kid, I had issue 2 of a 3-part story, yeah. And that's the only one I had.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, but so, I mean, and there were certain comics that, you know, I've said this before. There's a series called Micronauts that was coming out in the 70s, and I remember buying issue... I don't know why I get confused anymore, but I'm pretty sure it was issue. It's either issue 5 or issue 7. I'm only second guessing because I got it wrong on Twitter the other day and it made me mad. But it was like this one issue of Micronauts, and that is the book I still credit with the comic book that made me love comic books. I bought it at a grocery store that was next to my dad's office, and I sat in the back room of my dad's office and read that comic a dozen times that first day, just read it over and over again, and that is still to it was Micronauts, and they fought man, or they met Man Thing, and you know it was a swamp and riverboats and or swamp boats and little robots, and it just had everything that could have spoken to me as a comic in a comic book. That's what really. Even though I'd read tons of comics before, that was the book that has stuck with me since then, and it was. I still say. Even though it was a toy line that had been inspired this comic, the writer built a world around those toys. This wasn't when every toy had a cartoon that kind of built the mythology of the toys. This was the comic book built any mythology that those toys have ever had. And I always just love that that element.
So you also talked about like when you first broke in. It seems like a lot of your stuff has aimed towards more horror themed. I know that a lot of the comics that you used to love were like Man Thing or the monster comics and things like that. So is that specifically why you've done a majority of your comics work had that horror?
I don't know. I mean, I did read a lot, like you said, random House of Mystery, and I did read a lot of those random horror comics when I was a kid. I don't know why I did this, but I remember my dad used to go to the creek to fish. All right, everyone, let's have Helen tell a redneck story. My dad used to go to the creek. He used to go to the creek to fish with he fished with old cane poles whenever we went to the creek. And for whatever reason, whenever he did that, I would bring a stack of comics, but I always picked all the horror comics. It was always House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Ghost. That's the stuff I wanted to bring to the creek. For whatever reason, I wanted to sit on the creek side and at the bank and read horror anthology comics. I don't know where that came from, why I made that decision, but that's what I wanted to read whenever I went to the creek with my dad. So I've always loved horror comics, and then I think when I went into prose, when I was focusing on prose for so long, I was very much focused on writing horror stories, and that just has translated. I don't only write horror stuff, but I definitely it's sort of my it's definitely a niche I'm comfortable in.
And so the first book that you kind of broke through with was The Damned.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
So The Damned is a 1930s mob story with demons running the mob from behind the scenes. I have copies at my table in the booth of the first trade if anybody's interested in it. So it was a book I did with Brian Hurt, was the artist, and Brian and I met actually working at we both worked at a comic book store, and that was fortunate for me, as I met someone who was a talented artist at the beginning of his career, and I forged a friendship with him, and we knew we wanted to do something together. We just didn't know when that would happen, and it took several years before timing was right that Brian and I came together and we said, hey, let's do a comic. And The Damned is the book we did. It was published by Oni Press almost 10 years ago. And I thought at the time, I was like, well, there it is, my first comic's out. Everything else is gravy. I'm now a famous comic book writer. I can, you know, kick back and relax. And the offers for work are going to start flowing in. And those offers for work did not start flowing in. So it took me a while after that. After the Damned, I still had to maintain a full-time day job to pay my bills after the Damned. And the book's been, it had a very, it, the critical reception of the book was great. It was a small press book, so it didn't, I'm not going to, you know, it sold fine. It didn't, but it's not a household name by any means. So it took me a while after that to actually find the, to break into that I could do it full time.
And was it the success of the Sixth Gun that then kind of really, the Damned led to the Sixth Gun, Gun led to everything else?
Yeah, so after the Damned, I did a book called The Sixth Gun, again with Brian Hurt. Which is an epic fantasy in the Old West. Again, I have trades of the Sixth Gun at my table.
And completely unbiased, it's a fantastic, fantastic book. It really is.
Well, so. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. If you want to buy some trades, I have them.
I got them all. All right.
But no, so after the Damned, I started doing the Sixth Gun, which is epic fantasy set in the Old West, about six magical pistols, each pistol with its own unique power. And then it just blows up into this big epic storyline. And that book got the attention of editors at DC and Marvel, and they started reaching out to me and offering me work with them. And that really led to more work at DC and Marvel and more creator-owned projects. And the Sixth Gun has continued. I mean, we just put out our 47th issue. And the series is going to end with issue 50, so we're three issues away from ending the series, which is a little bittersweet. After having written, you know, close to 50 issues of these characters, we'll end the series with issue 50.
The side little miniseries as well.
So yeah, we've done a number of little miniseries that have connected. You know, we've done some miniseries that have been prequels to the main book. But we always wanted to keep that story of the main book going, moving forward without kind of derailing it by doing these spinoffs. But, you know, I'm excited to see the book end, not because I'm tired of it, but I love the book, but I feel like there's a value in things having an ending.
Yeah.
And we've known where the Sixth Gun was going since issue 3 or 4. I sat down with Brian and I said, this is where the book ends. This is how the story unfolds, which was really nice that we knew where we were ending, and we were able to move the pieces to make it all make sense as the story goes. You know, it's pretty obvious that you know the story's going somewhere.
And, you know, as the series got acclaim, got attention, didn't just get attention from editors at DC and Marvel, it also ended up, they shot a pilot. Talk about that, like that. How crazy that experience was.
Well, yeah, it was pretty intense. I guess it's been a couple of years now, but so NBC wanted to do a TV show based on the Sixth Gun, and they shot the pilot to introduce the series to the network and everything. They decided to pass on it, so the series never came out. There has been one episode of the series. Shot, and it's been you can't find it anywhere. It's not. That's the question. Can we find it on YouTube? Maybe one day, but not right now. It's not on YouTube or anything. Oh yeah, I've seen it. I mean, it's it was pretty surreal from the very beginning. It's we were very involved in it. I mean, it's a departure from the comic. They changed the comic to fit sort of the network model that they were the network they were trying to sell the show to. They kept us involved. You know, we all saw all the scripts, all the audition tapes, all the test footage. I was on set for, you know, a few days, which was pretty bizarre walking onto this Old West, walking into this Old West town, because it was filmed in New Mexico, in the town where they shot Wyatt Earp and things like that. So it's a town. And we walked into the town and we walked. They said go wait in the in the saloon, and we walk into the saloon, and there's all these extras dressed as cowboys, and they all turn as smoky and hazy. It was really like walking into the past. But it was exciting to be involved in the show. Everybody involved in the show, from the director to the writer to the producer, they all loved the Six Gun. They weren't just making a show on a title. They really liked the book, and so it was nice to talk to the actors about where they saw the characters going and everything. And in the end, you know, there's a pilot that I have a DVD of at home, and every now and again I can put it in and watch it and see what could have been.
But can't you anonymously?
No, that would do me no good.
did the pilot match your vision? From what you've written and what you've seen on page?
No, it was pretty different from there were obviously the main idea was there, but it was pretty different from the comic in terms of tone, I think. There were elements that I thought were very close to the comic, but part of what I liked about it was it wasn't exactly the comic. There were things that in the show that were not in the book that I liked. There were a couple of characters that were not in the book that I was like, oh, I really like those characters, and they're fun to watch on screen because I have no connection to those characters. Yes?
So is anything going to be done with, like, the dam, or has anyone tried to offer any kind of TV series for that?
Well, the Damned has been... originally, the Damned was with DreamWorks Pictures. They were going to make a film of it. That didn't happen, and then it was with Showtime, and Showtime was going to do a series on it. Now I'm not sure where it is. Things like that, you know, they change constantly.
There's
still possibilities with Six Gun, and that's why the pilot hasn't been leaked out by anybody publicly, because they're still trying to sell it. There's other networks that are interested in the show. If they were to pick it up, it would be a complete from back to the drawing board, because the actors who were in the show have moved on to other projects. Other people who were involved in the show have moved on. And that's one of the reasons the show hasn't been seen anywhere else. The only place the show has been publicly shown is George R. R. Martin, the author of the creator of Game of Thrones, has a movie theater in New Mexico, and he in Santa Fe, and he actually went out and said, I'd like to show the pilot of the Six Gun. And for like one weekend, we went out and we showed the pilot of the Six Gun 8 or 9 times over the course of the weekend to fairly sizable audiences there in his theater, and then it got a great, which was bittersweet, because the reaction to it was, you know, awesome. Everybody loved it. But then I was sitting there thinking the whole time, well, this is the only time it's ever going to be seen.
Yeah.
Because I have asked if there's any chance to show the pilot at conventions, and the answer is no, no, no. I like that George R. R. Martin, who's a delightful human being, he has the power to get my pilot shown in his, but I do not. So.
Well, so again, saying that there are still options out there, because, you know, with the success Daredevil has had on Netflix, you know, I couldn't help but think, do a Netflix series, or, you know, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was originally going to be an NBC thing.
Right. Well, Netflix has shown interest in the show. Netflix is one of the, you know, one of the outlets that has shown interest. The producer of the show, is Carlton Cuse, and right now he's been a little busy because he's doing The Strain and Bates Motel, so he's been very busy, so that takes a lot of time out of his schedule to get it out there. But, you know, there's still interest. At some point something will happen with it. I just don't know what that is, and really my job is to focus on the comics and not worry about the TV stuff. I mean, it's easy to get caught up in that world because it's exciting and interesting, but also it can derail the work I really want to do, which is all in comics.
What's the difference between working for like a superhero book versus the kind of the war stuff that you favor?
Well, the difference is it's creator owned versus big two. So, you know, the superhero stuff I do is from Marvel and DC, and they own those characters. Those are their characters. I will never own a piece of Spider-Man or Magneto.
Do they give
or,
you like a laundry list of things you can't do?
Well, they don't give me necessarily a laundry list of things I can't do. But when I'm working on their characters, I described it earlier today as you're playing with someone else's toys. And at the end of the day, you have to put the toys back in the toy box the way you got them. So it's super exciting to work on those toys because I love those characters growing up. But I also know at the end of the day, you know, there's someone else who owns those toys and is going to, you know, they may say, no, you can't write a story featuring this character because they're involved in another storyline, or another editor has a plan for them, or also we just don't like that story. They can say that, and I work for them. When it comes to creator-owned stuff like The Six Gun and The Damned and Helheim and Hellbreak and all those books, an editor might come to me and say, I'm not sure I like that story, and I can also tell the editor, well, I don't care what you like. These are my characters. This is my story. I'm going to tell my story the way I want to. That said, before any of my editors hear this and say, oh, Columbun thinks we're jerks, I have delightful editors who have great ideas, but at the end of the day, the characters belong to me and my collaborators on those.
Do you get any hate from Twitter because you've done something to their characters?
You get endless hate from Twitter, don't you?
We could talk forever about the amount of hate I get for what I have done to characters in comic books. How I have ruined characters for all time by some story I've written, you know, about a character, or what I'm currently getting, the amount of hate I'm getting for stories that have not even been published yet, that people have no idea what's going to happen. But I'm getting, you know, in June I take over Aquaman. And people have read solicits for Aquaman and are furious at me because of the three lines that they've read about what will happen in Aquaman. And I don't want this to sound bad because I love my readers, and you know, without readers, it's useless. It's for me to without readers, I don't write comics. But at the same time, it's not my job to make those to make people happy with every story I write. If I were to make people absolutely blissfully happy with every story, the stories never change, and that I can't do that. And yes, people are angry at me because they've read that Aquaman and his girlfriend Mara may not be together when I take over my book, and all I can say is you got to wait and see what happens in the story. I mean, my stories are going to, and that really goes for any of those Marvel or DC characters. Sometimes, yeah, my job is to make you mad. And to, you know, if you're not getting mad, you don't care about the characters.
That's what I was getting ready to say. It makes sense making someone mad so you can keep them hanging.
I remember when I was a kid and reading comic books. The big thing for me, and maybe for you, Steve, Storm in the X-Men lost her powers. And I flipped my lid. And it drove me nuts. It drove me nuts for months and months and months and months until she finally got her powers back. And I was like, oh, she got her powers back? I kind of like Storm without her powers. I think to some degree writers are supposed to make, you know, there should be an emotional connection to these characters. And my job is to try to elicit that, you know, that emotion from someone, whether it's, you know, happiness or sadness or anger. But yes, with Twitter and Facebook, you know, and just the internet in general and comments, people are very quick to voice their anger.
Do you avoid the comment section?
I do now. Sometimes I like to read, you know, these comments, and I admit I search for some of the comments sometimes just to see what people say. On Twitter, if someone if someone were to send me a message directly, my goal would be to respond to them. I'd like to respond to people, even if they sent me hate directly. And my favorite has always been, there's a guy who wrote, how does it feel to write the worst Deadpool story of all time? And I was like, so I wrote back to him and I said, oh, you are referring to New York Times best-selling Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, correct? And he wrote back and said, I can't believe you wouldn't take constructive criticism from me about this. Well, telling me that you know, I wrote the worst story ever, and your opinion is not constructive at all, but I appreciate it. It's just, you know, that's fine. And there are some blogs that have, you know, review blogs that really don't like me, and that's been, they're not going to like anything I write, no matter what. And I like reading those because they're funny. I mean, it's humorous to me, but I don't comment on them. And yeah, comment sections are the devil. I stay away from comment sections if I can. Mostly the stuff I see are, you know, I do see them, but I don't necessarily respond to them. Even though sometimes I say, oh, I really want to tell this guy.
Choke him.
I don't want to choke anybody, but yeah, I mean, I've seen people say things like, I want to break Cullen Bunn's finger so he can't write stories anymore. You know, and things like that. And that's fine. That's some idiot
that
saying.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some writers get death threats. Some, you know, it's,
really?
It's, yeah. I mean, people get very passionate about their superheroes, I guess. And it's usually in regards to superhero stories.
And when Dan Slott killed off Peter Parker.
Yeah, he got a lot of trouble. I mean, yeah.
And why? I mean, you know, Peter Parker's coming back. It's not forever.
Yeah, there is an evergreen state with all superheroes. And that's what people, you know, as much as I love superhero stuff, change is an illusion in superhero stuff. They will always revert to an evergreen state at some point. It may be 20, 30 years from now, but at some point, the change will be reverted.
How many times has Dick Grayson become Batman?
Right,
like,
I mean, that's,
you know, like four or five, and he always comes back to Bruce Wayne being,
yeah,
Batman.
So, you know, and that's fine. You know, I get it. People love the characters. I love the characters too. But
I didn't like when Peter Parker made a deal with the devil to get divorced or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't write that story. Come on, man.
It was that. This is an example.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the ones you did write or you are writing.
All right.
Right now you're doing for Marvel. Still Magneto.
Yes.
Yes. Moon Knight.
Yes.
What else?
So I'm writing Magneto, Moon Knight. Currently, Return of the Living Deadpool
oh,
is
yes,
coming out,
yes,
and
yes.
Then I'm writing a book called Deadpool's Secret Wars that will be coming out starting next month, I believe.
Bet you're looking forward to those emails, aren't you?
And the Deadpool people have come to embrace that. The Deadpool fans have come to accept me as one of their own, so it's okay.
Is it so secret that nobody shows up and he's like that person?
You're gonna bust my chops over that title. I didn't title it. I just came up with a story. So
well, yeah, I think that Deadpool is an interesting case where fans of Deadpool are okay with whatever the heck happens in this series is just for the fun of it, and it doesn't. They're not so continuity minded, I think.
Well, he's not going to remember it, so why should
right.
we?
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
I mean, I think Deadpool's a character where you can do anything with the character of Deadpool, really. And I think fans just want some sort of crazy. Yeah, they want the crazy stories. There are some that still, you know, there's a contingency of Deadpool fans who love the Daniel Way stories, and then there's a contingency that love the Jerry Dugan stories, and there's a contingency that like my stories. And sometimes there's some just like Deadpool in general.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's a character you can do anything with, and people are willing to accept that you can do anything. With Deadpool's Secret Wars, for instance, we're going back to... Well, Marvel's doing a big Secret Wars event that you may or may not know about. And they're doing a whole bunch of Secret Wars tie-ins, things that are happening during this event. Technically, my book is a Secret Wars tie-in, but it has nothing to do with the event. I think the tagline that they used was great. It's "Leave it to Deadpool to show up in the wrong event," and because my story, Deadpool Secret Wars, goes back to the original Secret Wars miniseries, the 12-issue series that came out in the 80s.
87.
Yeah, 86, 84, 85, I don't know. Anyway, in the 80s, and it assumes that Deadpool was always there. We just don't remember it. So it's and it's so it's in continuity. This is the story that happened. We don't remember. So if you remember Secret Wars, it starts with this big double page spread of all the characters introducing themselves. So it's like Captain America says, "I'm Captain America and I'm the Sentinel of Liberty," and then Wolverine says, "I'm Wolverine and I have claws." You know, they all basically give their name and their power set in a quick sentence. And, you know, Hulk says, "I'm Hulk, and I'm the strongest one there is." And then Deadpool pops out from behind Hulk and says, "And I'm Deadpool." And from that point on, Deadpool was always in Secret Wars. So,
is he responsible for the black costume?
Well, what you find out is that Deadpool is responsible for everything in Secret Wars. And again, it's all continuity. And you know, you'll find out that Deadpool, without Deadpool, it would have been a completely different outcome of that event.
Did he buy the black costume?
You got to buy that book. You got to buy the book to see, find out. But it's a super fun story because I get to play in this event and show you scenes that you didn't see during the event. But then also I have a framing story that I'm building in that I feel like has a lot of emotional resonance and actually is kind of a, you know, it's kind of an interesting story about with Deadpool as it, from a character point of view. And that's the kind of thing you can do with him. You can do these goofy stories but and also have sort of an emotional core to the character.
Your Magneto run still going strong, right?
Well, as part of Secret Wars, I'm doing a book called Last Days of Magneto. Ooh. So we'll have to see if that's literal. I can't tell you if that's the actual event, but the book, the next four issues that I'm writing are called The Last Days of Magneto. So
the Twitter response is like, "Oh,
And then Moon Knight, is that going to make it through Secret
Well,
Wars?
I was only hired to write five issues of Moon Knight.
Okay.
So I'm writing five issues of Moon Knight. That's, you know, when they came to me, they said, "We want you to do five issues and out." And so it was interesting because usually when I get offered a long book, a book that's ongoing, I want to pitch, you know, 12, 18 issues. But with Moon Knight, I knew right off the bat that it was only going to be five issues, so I was able to focus just on those five stories.
And are you... has that come out? Has that started coming out yet?
Yeah, my first issue of Moon Knight is out, and I think the next issue comes out like in a week or so. So,
and is it kind of continuing what Ellis did, like single issue stories?
Yeah, I'm gonna every issue of my Moon Knight is a standalone story. I just wanted to tell five standalone stories with sort of a thematic through line that kind of connects them. But yeah, they're all their own thing.
I didn't realize the first one is out.
Issue 13 was my first issue of Moon Knight, and it's been out for a few weeks. Thanks.
All right, so
thanks for the support, Steve.
I got a toddler. I can't always get to the comic
shop. All right, that's fair enough.
All right, for DC,
yes.
You're still doing Sinestro.
Writing Sinestro.
Lobo. Starting Aquaman.
Green Lantern, The Lost Army is the other book. Is a new book that starts in June.
Okay.
Yeah, June. And, so those are my four DC books.
So you're doing four DC books. You're doing four...
Don't do the math. It makes me nervous every time someone does the math of how much...
Does your brain explode? Like,
yeah, that's just what I'm wondering is, like, how many books are you writing at a time?
Well, to some degree, it's an illusion because some of the books that are coming out right now I have been done with for months. But I am very busy. I got a lot of books going on. I'm writing a lot of stories. In addition to the Marvel and DC stuff, I'm doing stuff for Dynamite, and I'm doing my own books, and so I'm very busy, and I work. It's shameful how many hours a week I work, but I work a lot of hours. I work 7 days a week, and mostly 10-hour days. But at the same time, I feel like if I didn't love this job. First of all, it took me forever to break in, as I was saying earlier. It took me a long time to break in. And now that I broke in, I feel like I got to grab on and hold on as tight as humanly possible and milk it for everything it's worth. And you know, this is a job I love, so I'm going to fight for it. You know, then that's why I work as hard as I do, and I've made a number of sacrifices to work in comics.
And you never know, too, that... the Silver Age in the 80s, and we were fans of writers, I'm sure, that, like, these days they can't get hired.
Right, yeah, that's true. The other thing is, I don't know when it's going to go away.
Yeah.
There's the other, next week I could not be working anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do as, you know, I, Someone told me I have trouble saying no to projects. Like someone offers me a work and I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. And they're absolutely right. The Cullen Bunn of 6 years ago would be shocked and horrified to hear me turn down a project, because 6 years ago I was begging for work. And you know, now that I'm in a position not to beg for work, you know, it's getting to be, it's very strange sensation to me to say no to a project. And I've started turning projects down, and it's just so difficult. And there are even things that, it's not even about nostalgia or loving certain characters. There are sometimes I've been offered work, and I'm like, these aren't characters I love. It's not a title I love, but I like the idea of what I could possibly do with those characters. So it's even in situations where I might be offered something, I can't say what those things are, but I've been offered things that I don't like, that I'm like, well, I want to see what I can do with it.
Yeah.
It's almost a challenge.
There's only so many hours in a week.
There's only so many hours in a week, and I'm going to have to start cutting some things out.
Yeah.
Question.
Kind of a two-part question, but going back to the Secret Wars for just a second.
Yeah.
What I found out about all of the series that will be ending.
Right.
The 33 different series. How is that going to affect you as far as writing, and B, which one are you going to miss the most?
What a question to ask. I will say this, first of all, things are sort of in flux. To be honest, I don't know where I'm going to be and what's going to happen yet. But I can tell you that if things work out the way they're supposed to, knock on this wooden stage, there's some very, very exciting things for me, but also I think for readers on the horizon. I am super excited for where the future could lead, but I can't say more than that.
Miss the most out of all this.
Well, you're assuming something's going to end. Maybe everything continues. I mean, maybe
I've seen some about how the X-Men are going to get like a refurbish from like back in the day, Hank didn't have the blue fur.
Well, for Marvel, if this is genuinely, and see how I'm going to answer your question without answering anything.
Right.
If this is genuinely the last days of Magneto, if we are never going to see him again, I'm going to miss Magneto.
if all right, that's a very political answer. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I don't mean to hog. About like story arcs. Like I was doing a redemption thing. I was talking to Joshua from the Harbinger, and he gave me the story arc like a redemption thing. Do you know anything that any books or TV shows that I could look at that could follow that mode of like a somebody who's an anti-hero being redeemed?
Well, I can say that we are in the era of the anti-hero. Everybody loves anti-heroes right now. If you're going to look at story arcs, I would look at Magneto. I would look at Sinestro. I'm being selfish, I'll admit it. I would look at Sinestro and Magneto, both books about villains and their quest for redemption, or even if they want redemption. If you're looking at TV shows, I think there's a number. I think if you haven't watched Breaking Bad, you're cheating yourself, because it's a wonderful story. I think Justified is a story of redemption, and it's just, a wonderful story.
Yeah.
So those are the two that immediately jump to mind. You know, Breaking Bad, from a position of, this is a story of one man who could get everything and is willing to, could be redeemed.
Yes.
But is also willing to let his pride, who is so proud, he cannot accept success and is willing to let pride destroy him, mm-hmm. which is to me just a great story anyway. There's a great story there. But I think we're in the era of anti-heroes and villains right now.
I always used to recommend The Shield, but
Please, The Shield's an awesome show too. Yeah.
I was a little disappointed in how The Shield ended, and so my love.
Well, you are wrong. You are wrong.
Painted a little bit, but
you are wrong.
I mean, I would say the first three seasons are flawless.
All right,
flawless.
Now I'm going to punch Steve Higgins right now in the head because The Shield is an amazing show. So I think you had two questions, right? You had a two-parter.
I think we got them.
Did we get them all?
Yes,
yes we did.
Okay.
You kind of answered without.
I can't. Okay, good. All right.
I was just going to ask, you know, you've done a lot of work with the big two, with DC and Marvel, but you've done a lot of independent. Is it hard to go back and forth between, you know, the established characters and the two different universes and then also with your own stuff? And
you guys are literally asking questions I had planned on asking, so this is, that's awesome. You'll just get to sit here.
I don't necessarily find it difficult to move between types of stories, even like tones. Like I'm working on, if I work on a book that's for all ages, like Terrible Lizard, I don't necessarily have trouble moving to a darker story like Magneto or Helheim or whatever. But the biggest challenge, I guess, for me is I'm working on, say, Marvel and DC, and I'm working on Magneto for Marvel, I'm working on Sinestro for DC, is I have to make sure those stories have different lines. And sometimes I find myself saying, oh, I'm following very similar lines on these two stories, and I have to change and make sure I'm giving readers different stories. So I don't want someone who reads both those books to feel like, oh, I'm telling the same story. I'm trying to... and that's a challenge. That can be a challenge, especially working on characters who... I think Magneto and Sinestro are very different, but I can also see why people can see very, you know, big similarities between the two.
And yeah, that's... Silver Age Marvel fans will know. I mean, you can tell sometimes when Stan was up against a deadline because Thor sounds just like Daredevil, that sounds just like... and so you even see some dialogue. I'd flip through Essentials, and I'm like, I swear I read that dialogue in a different, like a Thor book, and now it's in a Silver Surfer book. Yeah. But yeah, that effort to, I'm doing so much, but they all got to be their own thing. That must be a difficult
thing. It can be a challenge, and I'll admit even, I've used... It just, you know, certain phrases or lines or themes get stuck in my head, and they'll show up in both books, but hopefully I'm addressing them in slightly, I'm giving sort of different views on those themes. Sometimes maybe not. You know, when you start seeing Sinestro using magnetic powers, then you know that I've completely lost it. I've completely gone off the rail.
I sent the wrong script to the wrong editor.
Right.
Kind of like along with hers, when you're doing so many different projects, your own and the big two and all that. How do you get yourself out of one mindset into the other?
If I have to do something to get myself in a mood, sometimes I'll read what I feel like are great issues of a certain character. When my creator-owned stuff, I don't really have that. I don't really have to get myself pumped up to write them. At most, maybe I can watch a TV show that is sort of in the theme of what I want to go or has the right mood for me. But yeah, I'll read great issues of a character or just a great arc of a book, a completely different book that I want to, or a writer that I admire or something like that. I'll read some of their issues just to get the juices flowing to write those kind of stories. Sometimes I have to do that. So that's, I buy my comics. That's where, I put it down as research because I'm reading.
So let's talk about some of the independent stuff that you're doing. You got Wolf Moon with Vertigo. It's a 6-issue miniseries. What, 4 are out, or is the
5 is out? So the 6th issue of Wolf Moon will be out soon, and then that'll be done. Yeah.
Werewolf story.
Yeah.
Interesting take on a werewolf.
Yeah, I'm trying to do something different with a take on werewolves that you haven't seen before.
And it's very good stuff. And Jeremy Hahn, artist, is also here. So
yes.
Pick that up and get a sign. Terrible Lizard, complete opposite end of the spectrum. You got Vertigo, violent horror stuff, and now you got Terrible Lizard, all ages.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Terrible Lizard's an all ages dinosaur story.
Of course, Hellbreak. Did you all get your copies of the first issue?
So,
if you haven't yet, they have them at the front desk.
Yeah.
Please pick one up.
Yeah, Hellbreak just came out. First issue. Second issue hasn't hit the stands yet. Hellbreak is a SEAL team story. You imagine a story about a SEAL team, out crack team of mercenaries going out on missions. Only their mission is to go into hell and retrieve lost souls. And like I said, the first issue they're giving away here at the show, but you can get the first issue at your local shop. I mean, it was you can get the first issue, just came out, and the second issue hasn't been out yet. And from that first issue, which is sort of a standalone story, we really take it in some big directions and really blow that story out and build in a lot of mystery and character interactions and character stories and intrigue that I'm excited to see with it.
When will the second issue? The
second issue comes out in a couple of weeks, so it's soon. But your retailers can still get them if you haven't ordered it. They can get them in for sure.
All right, this is a little audio enhancement from the panel from earlier today, the 10th annual Cape Comic Con, and I'm here with Colin Bunn. And Colin, just first of all, fantastic panel this morning, and I hope that people listening at home or on their mobile devices were able to enjoy it as much as the people in the panel room.
Yeah, no, it's a fun panel. It's funny because all of those, every time I do one of those, you can tell if it's a good one or a bad one, because the bad ones you're ready to get out, and that one it flew by. I was ready to. I would have liked to keep talking for a long time. Believe me, I can talk. So I was ready to keep going for a while, but it was a good time.
In the panel, we talked, and I won't have you rehash the entire thing, certainly, sure. But you talked about that grocery store next to your dad's office, and you know, kind of where you would get your comics. Are we talking spinner racks or shelf? I mean, was that the main source of you acquiring comics at a young age?
Yeah, well, aside from grocery stores, the main place for me to buy new comics were either spinner racks or, you know, the shelves, the sort of cascading waterfall shelves in grocery stores and in, you know, like 7-Elevens. And I remember there was I talked about fishing earlier. There was when we would fish on the coast, we drove by this, like, huge, like, massive bait and tackle place. And for whatever reason, they had a great selection of comic books. And that was another place that I'd get comics from. And it was always, you know, just whatever happened to be on the rack is what, you know, that was my selection.
As you continue reading, and I know, as you just said, whatever they had, it sounds to me like there wasn't any real standout character or anything like that for you, at least early on. Did you ever kind of develop a favorite story or a favorite character that you like to follow?
Yeah, you know, early on I would read whatever it was, and then, you know, I mentioned Micronauts earlier, and that became a comic that I really stuck with me for a long time. It's always been one of my favorites. And then I was a big X-Men collector. You know, X-Men was an important comic to me, not only because I just love the X-Men, But my dad was never into comics, but my dad loved the art of collecting and haggling with dealers, and that was something we did together. As we, you know, we built a collection of X-Men from number one on to whatever was current at the time I stopped collecting, and that was, you know, my dad. That was something we did together. So X-Men's always been important to me because of that.
You've been writing professionally for comics now for 10 years.
Almost
10 years.
Yeah.
All right. Was that your first foray, your first step in professional writing? Did you have anything else that you had that you worked to get published from the novel side or anything like that? Or has your focus mainly been on comics?
Well, no, I've sold a few short stories and, you know, and I've sold some articles. Like, my first published work that I was paid for was in Fangoria magazine. I did some, you know, did some articles for Fangoria. And then, yeah, I sold some short stories and things of that nature. But, yeah, comics is really, that's where I was able to kind of stake my claim, I guess.
And at what point did you kind of decide that it was writing that you wanted to pursue? And how did you go about that as far as, you know, following that as an educational path?
Well, I've known for a long time I wanted to tell stories. I went to school. My degree is, you know, I have a Bachelor of Arts in creative writing, which is not necessarily the degree that gets you a lot of jobs. It's not people would say it's not a smart degree from a professional standpoint, probably. But so, you know, I did a degree in that, and I went into marketing for a long time after. After that, I worked in marketing for close to, you know, 15 years, and finally, just one day, I decided it was time to make that step to try to become a, you know, a full time writer. I was getting work, and I figured if I stepped away from the day job, I would be able to commit more time to it. So I just kind of it was a leap of faith in a lot of ways, but I haven't looked back since.
And as far as that marketing background, did that help you as far as, you know, finding outlets for your stories, as far as, you know, finding a publisher who would, you know, just selling the story to an editor?
Well, I don't know that that the marketing background helped me with, you know, getting work from editors. I don't know that that necessarily helped, but you know, working in sort of a professional environment like I was for so long, what I do think it did was help me focus on getting the job done, help me focus on meeting deadlines, meeting commitments that I make, and that's really, for a lot of aspiring creators, that's the element they don't think of. You know, that you think of, you write comics for a living. That's got to be the most fun job ever, and I would agree, but it's still a job, and that's the thing that a lot of people don't necessarily see that aspect of it. And I think that helped me just,
you know, it,
working like that forever, just for what feels like forever, definitely helped me focus on those aspects of the job. And also, to be honest with you, I was doing a job that I wasn't super thrilled with. It also helps me that I never want to go back to something like that. So that's, you know, I'm gonna work as hard as I can to make sure that I keep this dream alive.
As far as that goes, I mean, hardest part of what you do right now, what would you say if there was just, you have to throw, you know, one thing out there that's just, maybe it's meeting a deadline, or as you mentioned in the panel, making sure that the Magneto story and the Sinestro story aren't very, you know, aren't parallels of each other. What is the hardest part of doing what you do?
You know, I think there's stuff in addition to the writing the comics. That some of the stuff that's what I call upkeep work, that is sometimes the hardest thing. You know, keeping my website up to date, keeping out there. Keeping in touch with editors, keeping in touch with, you know, retailers, keeping in touch with media outlets, and just, you know, making sure I'm always talking about the work, because doing the work is only half the job, really. Especially when you look at creator-owned stuff, you really have to, you know, work hard to keep that in front of the readers, and that's probably something that it's not that it's necessarily hard, but it's definitely hard to balance it with the actual writing the books. And especially with me, I'm writing so many projects, or I'm working on so many projects, it's difficult to focus on that side of things. And sometimes I let that slip a little more than I want to.
If I'm remembering correctly, a few weeks back, maybe a month, something like that, maybe it was even a little bit more, might have stretched all the way back to February, you participated in like a streaming Q&A through Twitter. I remember walking into my my brick and mortar comic shop and seeing you on there. That kind of interaction, coming out to the cons, things like that, where you're able to, you know, meet the fans, and as we learned in the panel, not everybody is you know, as excited, but you know, hopefully they come around. But rate that experience as far as getting out here and meeting the public.
Yeah, that's really the best part of going to conventions. It's is that I'm actually able to meet the readers face to face, you know, talk about the books, and hopefully, you know, build the audience up. And it's not just retailers. You know, I want to meet, or not just readers. It's retailers as well. That's really what I think is the most important aspect of conventions to me is I could come to a convention and not bring anything to sell. That's not the goal for me, is to sell books. But to actually meet the retailers and stuff, meet the retailers, meet the readers. That's the thing that I really look forward to when I come to these shows.
Hellbreak number one is on store shelves. It's at my brick and mortar. I'll even give them a shout out. Twilight Comics, Shiloh, Illinois. And not too far from your home stomping grounds. But we learned a little bit about it. It's kind of that SEAL team type, you know, going into the pits of hell, if you will.
Right.
Where did the idea come from? How did this story come about?
You know, it's interesting, because it's a story that came to me years and years ago. It's not one that that it's not real recent that I came up with the idea. I pitched it to the publisher, Oni Press, at the same time I pitched Hellbreak, and I pitched a book called Hellheim. And I figured, well, they both have similar titles, but they won't take both of them, so it's not a big deal. But they did take both of them, so I've got, you know, I guess I have a lot of hell-based titles.
Best happy accident ever.
Right, yeah. you know, I think Hellbreak just came from the fact that I wanted to tell sort of an action movie, tough guy story, sort of a Dirty Dozen type type story, but I wanted to make sure there were supernatural elements because that just that spoke to me, and I felt like that's what would get me excited about the project. And I like the idea of putting putting a team of characters who are not superheroes. They don't have superpowers. They're not magical. They're just soldiers, and they're good at their job. And then putting them in the most supernatural of elements. And that's really where it came from, was just a desire to see where that might play out, how that might play out.
Well, I'm excited to read Hellbreak, and I'm excited to read The Sixth Gun, which I have in my hand right now. And this is only volume one, and I've got lots of volumes to go just to get caught up. So, Brian, Tim over at Twilight, I'm going to be talking to you about some orders. But Colin, I want to thank you very much for taking a few minutes out of your con experience to visit with me and get on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for talking with me, man. It was fun.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.
Hey, this is Cullen Bunn, the writer of Magneto, Sinestro, The Sixth Gun, and Hellbreak, reminding you to keep listening to Nerds United and all the great shows on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network.